Presents John Gambling with the mayor of the greatest city in the world, Mike Bloomberg.
Johnny Donovan, that means today is a Friday, and yes, indeed, time here on the John Gambling Show to welcome aboard once again Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Mr. Mayor, good morning.
Good morning, and you'll notice how warm it is outside. I mean, February, it's unbelievable. Last week was cold, this week warm.
Yeah, well, that's the way it works. A little up, a little down, a little here, a little there. Hey, listen, do I understand correctly that yesterday was your birthday?
Myself and roughly 1/365th of the entire world's population had a birthday yesterday.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Every year I look forward to my birthday. I always want to have more of them. Never understood people that didn't. And yesterday's, I got a nice thing. The Cake Man Raven, who I know you know who Cake Man Raven is.
Cake Man Raven?
Cake Man Raven sent me 150 cupcakes for my birthday. Cake Man Raven actually is a pretty famous guy in the Fort Greene community. He was has a business on Fulton Street, and when that neighborhood was falling apart, old Cake Man Raven started a baking shop that actually turns out to be pretty good, and a lot of people like his stuff. His signature cake, the Red Velvet, it has been sent to Japan for Thanksgiving and London for Valentine's Day and Hong Kong with a dance company, and it's not good for my waistline, John, but I love it.
I was going to say, you didn't eat all 120.
I did not eat all 150, but I did eat
50,
more.
50, okay. All right, well, good for you. Congratulations again. Let's get into it a little bit here. Let's see, where do I want to start? Your reaction to the Waxman hearings and Roger Clemens and Brian McNamee?
Well, I'll leave it to Congress, but you would think that they've got other things to worry about. The country has big problems. And let the courts or the Major League Baseball worry about steroids. I'm not so sure why this is something Congress should get involved in, but I'll stay out of that one.
Well, I think it kind of dovetails to another comment that you made this week about Congress kind of trying to look for easy answers to complex issues. This was something that they could do and didn't have to make a decision. They let slip, and they have not voted on, the House has not voted on, a security measure this week as they went away for the long weekend.
You couldn't write the script. Nobody buy the movie or the book. There are serious problems. There are no easy solutions. There is cost and pain in doing anything, and nobody wants to talk about it. It's an election year. It's a feel-good year, and they're going to keep doing this. But, I think the baseball thing was just an excuse to get some publicity, and I'm sympathetic with that. If that's what they want to do, let them do it. I do think that it's sad for Major League Baseball with all of this steroid use. I don't know in this particular case who's telling the truth or whether or not this particular pitcher did it or this particular trainer gave it to him. But steroids sort of taint professional sports because maybe we confuse in our minds. We all want professional sports to be like amateur sports, and they're not. Professional sports is entertainment. There's an enormous amount of money involved, and we sort of envision them out there as just natural ability and striving, and we try to give characteristics to professional athletes that, there's certainly some that are just great role models. And then there are some who just, will do anything for a buck. And, it's a big industry, and there's going to be good people and bad people. And I don't know. Shame.
It is indeed. Tell me a little bit more about your comment this week that our balance sheet is making the United States look like a third world country.
Well, we keep spending money we don't have, which means since you got to eventually pay it back, we are leaving the bill to our kids. I've got to get this right, but somebody once said the difference between a children's party and an adult party, in a children's party, the adults pay, and in an adult's party, the children pay. And that is true. And, people that say deficits don't matter are just trying to say we can have something for nothing. You can't have something for nothing with your personal budget, and the government isn't any different. And the ability to print money, it means that for a short period of time, you don't get caught. But over a long period of time, this country is transferring its wealth overseas every day in enormous quantities to countries that are selling us oil. And countries are using those to build up their industries, their schools, or to support terrorism, or a lot of things that compete with us or not in our interest. And we're not doing anything about it. Now, there's no easy overnight answer, but we should be focusing on alternative sources of energy so that we're less reliant on foreign oil. We're not investing in our infrastructure, where we have to have a good infrastructure if we're going to have decades. I once said recently that if you'll go back to the to FDR and the recovery program after the Great Depression, they did two things. One, they did create jobs, and that was great for the people then. But more importantly for the country, they created the infrastructure that we use for the next two or three decades to grow on, and we're not doing that.
Every time I look around New York City, to things like the Midtown Tunnel or the George Washington Bridge, they were all built in that era. And as you say, you wonder why that era, and we know politically now and economically why things were done that way with the New Deal and the rest of it. But it was, as you say, a leap forward for the United States.
Yeah, and we're not doing that now. Now, maybe we had a much bigger crisis than we do today. And, in some senses, it's easier to get people together and do the right thing when there's a crisis. When it's not a crisis, everybody says, well, don't worry about that. Let's just do what's politically expedient. But we have to make the investment. The biggest investment we're not making, John, is in our schools. This country is a country that we want to have our workforce get paid wages that will let them share in the great American dream. But we live in an international world where we have to compete with everybody else. So if we're going to pay our workers more but still be able to sell our products and that compete with others, we have to find a ways to either use technology to make our workforce more efficient and able to do more per capita. That's one way to do it. Or train our workforce to do those kinds of jobs that other countries wouldn't be able to do because their workforce is not trained. And sadly, what's happening is other countries are training their workforce and we are not. And you're going to see one of these days countries moving jobs over here, but the low-paying jobs. I mean, everything, we talk about outsourcing because labor is cheaper overseas. We don't want a world where the rest of the world outsources to America because our labor is cheaper. We want our workers to be able to earn, a good wage where they can support their family. But then you're not going to get it by legislation. You're only going to get it in the marketplace by having education standards raised, and we don't do that.
Education standards raised, and this is one of those difficult questions, I think, in the big theoretical picture, is the fact that we offer everybody the opportunity for an education, does that hinder our potential?
Do we not
segment enough as we go through the years, through high school, college? Do we not, direct people in more specific ways?
No, I mean, I think you should, for example, offer vocational education. College is not right for everybody, I've said, but education is right for everybody. You can't do a construction job without having a good education. You can't work for the sanitation department in this city without having a high school diploma. We've got to raise our standards, and you want to make sure that everybody gets an education. Remember, let's assume you don't have kids in school. You say, well, why do I care about public schools? I'll tell you why you care, because the voters of tomorrow and the workforce that's going to pay your Social Security are the kids in public schools today. And so you'd have a very selfish or personal interest in how good public education is, even if they're not your kids, because they're going to be the citizens of your city and your state and your country. And I think that we don't educate everybody. We do, in fact, in this country, have the best university system. People come from around the world still to get a PhD or a master's or an undergraduate degree in this country. The quality of our university-level education is the best in the world. Sadly, below that, it is not. And when they get their education, people from around the world, sadly, we make it very difficult for them to stay here, which a lot of them would love to do. You know, we have a wonderful country. People come here for an education. They see it. They want to stay here. They get their education, and then we won't give them a green card. And we, those are the people who would create jobs for everybody else. And it's just, you know, it's craziness.
All right, Mr. Mayor, I've gone a little long here. We have gone a little long here. Let me take our first break. We'll be coming right back. And don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, your opportunity to ask Mayor Michael Bloomberg the questions comes later on, 1-800-848-WABC. John Gambling right here at 77 WABC with Mayor Michael Bloomberg, our Friday edition. Mr. Mayor, you were traveling this week down to the old haunt, Baltimore, and along with the mayor down there, Sheila Dixon, talking about a new gun database.
We are continuing our efforts to try to track down and get illegal guns off the streets. And this is a database where the police will put ballistic information and information from interviews all together. And then what happens is you can find patterns and you can trace one gun back to multiple shootings. And you can share the information with other jurisdictions all along the East Coast. And we think that it'll help police reduce the number of shootings. You know, this month, John, so far has just been tragic.
I mean, the situation yesterday out in Illinois is horrible.
I asked Suloza to get me a list of things that had occurred just this month alone. Yesterday, Northern Illinois University, six people, another one died this morning, six people killed. Last Friday in Baton Rouge, a college student shot and killed two people and then took his own life. Last Thursday, a gunman shot and killed five people in Kirkwood, Missouri, in the city hall, killed two city council members and two police officers. And the mayor was very seriously wounded, and he's hanging in there, but who knows. And then on February 2nd, just a week ago, in a Lane Bryant store in Illinois, a gunman shot and killed five customers and employees, all women from, you know, in their 20s and 30s.
All right, how do we deal with this, Mr. Mayor? I mean, this guy, I understand, by the name of Steve Kazmersak, was allegedly the guy who was doing the shooting yesterday out in the college in Illinois. He had a shotgun, a couple of handguns, which he bought last week. I mean, how do you stop something like this?
Well, you know, if you look at our crime rate in this country versus other Western developed countries, it's all pretty much the same with one exception, and that is murder. And we're something like 17 times more likely to get killed per capita than all of these other countries. And we just stand out like this one sore thumb. Now, with the Second Amendment guarantees your right to bear arms, I don't have a problem with that. Some people, would like to shoot for sport and hunt for sport. I don't have a problem with that. That's their decision. But the federal laws say you can't sell guns to criminals. And the truth of the matter is, it is much too easy for criminals to get guns, and they get them from people that know that they're criminals and know they're going to only buy these guns to commit robbery or mayhem or murder people, and they go ahead and do it. And the city, if you remember, had this sting operation. We went down, we hired a private firm, we went down to Pennsylvania and South Carolina and Virginia, I think, the states where a lot of these guns come from, and using old trace data, which lets you go back and look and see who originally sold the gun, we found a handful of stores that looked to us like they deliberately sold or knowingly sold to criminals. And some of them, when we went in and pretended to be a buyer, said, no, you don't have the right paperwork, and they acted honorably. But, you know, 1% of the gun dealers in this country sell something like 60 or 70% of the guns that we confiscate after a robbery or murder on the streets of New York City.
One of those South Carolina dealers was indicted just yesterday.
That is a guy who, most of them, incidentally, have agreed to settle with the city. We didn't ask for any money. All we asked is that they stop the practice and have a monitor to just make sure they obey the current federal laws. The NRA always says, you know, we don't need more laws. I couldn't agree more. We have enough laws in the book. What we have to do is enforce them, and Congress has been getting in the way, although the ATF lately has been much more cooperative, in all fairness. And the federal government indicted a guy yesterday who is somebody who I've met. I gave a deposition. He is suing the city and suing me personally for slander and defamation of character and all that sort of stuff. And then yesterday he got arrested for doing exactly what we alleged that he did. And, you know, we'll see how all this plays out in the courts. But, you know, we're not trying to kill – we're not trying to take away anybody's business. We're not trying to take away anybody's right to hunt or have sports or protect themselves. All we're trying to do is to enforce the laws that say criminals can't have guns. And we've got 250 mayors together in the Mayor's Coalition Against Illegal Guns. They come from the east and west of the Mississippi and north and south of the Mason-Dixon line, from big cities and small cities, and represent something like 50 million people in the United States, the mayors who are in this group. And, you know, every day, I think it's about 34 people get killed with handguns, just most of them illegal. Just think about that. Virginia Tech was 32 people, and then Virginia, the state, enacted a law after that to make it more difficult to go after people that sold guns to criminals. And you couldn't write this. Nobody would believe it. Right after all of that, they went ahead and did that. But we are killing 34 people a day. There's something like 3 or 4 kids who get killed playing with their parents' guns every day. And there's something, last I saw the numbers, something like 44 suicides. So 80 people are getting killed every single day with guns.
Without limiting the legal access to guns, how do you reduce the numbers? Or is it that... you just want to take it out of the hands of
bad folks. You have a right to bear arms. You don't have a right if you're a minor. You don't have that right if you have a criminal record. And Congress just recently passed a bill. You don't have that right if you have psychiatric problems and have been treated for them. And, you know, there's a whole list of criteria. So the Second Amendment gives you the right to bear arms, but it isn't universal. It isn't to everybody. And if we could enforce the laws and make sure kids don't buy them and criminals don't buy them and people who have deep emotional problems don't buy them, you'd go a long ways towards solving the problem. You wouldn't eliminate it. Maybe we're just going to have some kind of a higher rate of people getting killed with guns as long as we allow everybody to have a gun, which is in the Constitution, and we're not going to change that.
All right,
but
Mr. Mayor.
This is so much worse than that. It's insanity.
Yeah, I mean, it is, and your statistic about the fact that we are 17 times more likely than people of other countries to end up being shot and murdered is a scary statistic.
Keep in mind, in New York City, we've brought down the murder rate dramatically. The PD, Ray Kelly and all those people have really made a big difference. It's still high. It's still, last year, 496, I think, murders occurred. That's the bad news. The good news is most of them seem to be among killing drug dealers, and we have reduced crime, murder rate for domestic violence victims, which people said you couldn't do, and we've cut that in half. You know, so we are making a lot of progress here, and this year, you know, it's a month and a half, but we're doing the same just as well as we did last year so far. But, you know, and one of the sad things you talked before about Congress and looking at Roger Clements and the steroids, the truth of the matter is the murder rate's going up throughout the country. Crime is going up throughout the country, even while it's coming down in New York City. And that's something Congress should be worried about.
They should be absolutely worried
about. A lot more important than whether or not, you know, somebody uses steroids.
All right, Mr. Mayor, sit tight. Half hour break time. We will do that. We're coming back to Mayor Michael Bloomberg and you, of course, 1-800. We are riding along on a Friday with Mayor Michael Bloomberg, our usual state here on the John Gambling Show at 77 WABC. We talked about this last week, Mr. Mayor. New York Racing Association, you said you weren't going to fund the bookie operation that you referred to OTB. Is that still part of the deal because the legislature has approved the bailout?
I will go to the OTB meeting next week, and we're going to vote to close it down, which we will do, I think, about June is when the procedure gets finished, unless the state stops taking 110% or 120% of the profits. I mean, what the bottom line is, we are funding, subsidizing a bookie operation. And some people say, oh, you know, you can't run it well, you're not making any money. That's not true. It is well run, and they are making money. The trouble is the state takes more than the amount of money. And so what we're doing is we're taking away money from, let's say, education and public safety and parks and culturals and sending it to Albany so they can subsidize other things. And it may very well be desirable to subsidize the racing industry. I don't, you know, that's fine. That's the state's decision. But they shouldn't do it on our backs. And given that we send $11 or $12 billion a year more to Albany than we get back, this isn't their money. It's our money.
Speaking of the state and the city and the relationship financially, I read this morning that the legislature has made it possible now for teachers in the state of New York to retire at full benefits 5 years earlier than previous. Doesn't that put a real strain again on the budget?
In all fairness, that's something that we negotiated with the teachers' union. We think it is in the city's interest and the teachers' union and the teachers' interest, and we needed Albany approval for it because it's a pension fund thing. So all Albany is doing is giving us permission to do what we negotiated through a free contract. Why did we negotiate it? Our total costs will be lower from this. Our total pension costs will be lower because some teachers will, senior teachers will retire, and the newer teachers get paid less than senior teachers. There's a graduation scale. And so our total costs will go down. And it was part of a package where we, at the same time, got performance pay for the schools, which we think is very important in terms of improving the education for our kids. And we also settled the lawsuit. I mean, there are a number of things done at the same time. But in all fairness, the legislature only did what the city and the teachers' union asked them to do. And the agreement that we negotiated with the teachers' union is a win-win for everybody.
The Speaker of the City Council had a State of the City address this week, and one of the things that she suggests is that teachers get bonus pay, if you will, additional monies for teaching in low-performing schools. Are you in favor of that?
You know, I've always thought that if people do a better job, they should get paid more, and if they do a worse job, they should get paid less. And you have to have both parts of that. And I think it's just a sign of the times, John. You know, everybody is so afraid to focus on education in this country because they don't want to, quote, fight the teachers' union. And yet in this city, we negotiated a performance pay with the principals' union. We negotiated performance pay with the teachers. And here the Speaker of the City Council is suggesting more of that kind of incentive to and rewards for doing a superior job. And she's certainly done it after talking to the teachers' union. It just goes to show the teachers' union, which here, which is one of the bigger teachers' unions, maybe the biggest teachers' union in the country, really is progressive. Yes, their job is to get the best conditions to work in and the most pay they can for their members. That's what unions do. But they also really can stand up and say, look, we at the same time are trying to improve the education that we provide our students. And I think the UFT should be commended. And I think those people seeking national office who are afraid to take on, quote, take on the teachers' union are looking at it the wrong way. Unions aren't necessarily the enemy. They are another party who has an interest, and you can negotiate with them. So, you know, you go and you negotiate a business deal with somebody. They're not the enemy. They've got their interests. You've got yours. You want to find a ways where you can both win. And we've done that, and the UFT deserves a lot of credit. I mean, we've got 80,000 of the best teachers in the world. Fewer teachers by a lot are resigning today than did 6 years ago. And the number of teachers from around the country who want to come to work here is off the charts. This last year, I think we had something like 50 or 60,000 applicants for 5,000 jobs. Teachers around the country know that the New York City school system is getting better, doing a better job, and that we pay our teachers well. They've gotten a 43% raise over the last 6 years. But in all fairness, they're teaching longer hours. They've changed work rules. They're doing a much better job. It's a win-win for everybody.
I know that the greening of New York City is high on your agenda list, and you and everybody in City Hall are working hard in various venues to make sure that this happens and is an initiative that continues over the years. I'm a little confused, and I need you to help me out here. The City Council has passed, proposing to pass a law about electronic recycling, and I understand that you think you might veto that.
Yes, we will veto it if it stays in the form that it is today, because what it does, well, look, nobody's more in favor of recycling. And the reason that you talk that we focus on electronic equipment is there's a lot of very heavy metal chemicals in the get in electronic components that if you just put into a garbage dump, they don't just go away with time the way paper would or some of the other things that get thrown, organic materials go away. These really pollute, and they pollute badly. But the trouble with this law that the City Council passed is that you hold the manufacturers responsible for the public to recycle. And the manufacturers can't do that. They don't know. They don't sell directly to the public in many cases. They sell to wholesalers. And the wholesalers, you can't, you're not being holding them responsible. But also, it's the individual's responsibility. And, you know, think of it. Let me give you another example. Let's assume that you pass the same law to recycle newspapers. Everybody wants to recycle newspapers. If you leave them out by the curb, we pick them up on certain days, and we have the sanitation department does recycle an enormous amount of newsprint that gets made into corrugated paper in Staten Island and other places. Holding the newspaper publishers responsible for the individuals to recycle their newsprint, I don't think it makes any sense. The newspapers don't know who buys the newspaper and can't force them to do it, and holding them responsible is just nonsensical. This is exactly the same thing. And trying to drive it's also, incidentally, totally illegal, this law. We will not enforce it, and we don't have to enforce it because it violates a whole bunch of federal laws on interstate commerce and due process and a variety
of things. Should the law read that the purchaser of a computer or electronic equipment is responsible for recycling, and therefore the city, the state, the country needs to have a process to do that?
Well, I think that does make some sense. For example, we have a law, you can't take your refrigerator and just take the gas is in at the Freon, and turn it out into the atmosphere. That's what's really causing global warming. That's a disaster. So we have a law that says you've got to call the city, and we'll take the gas away, and we'll take away your refrigerator. And that law is enforced, and people live with it, and it's not a great burden on anybody. It makes sense from all points of view. But there you're holding somebody responsible for actions that they themselves control, holding the manufacturer of a refrigerator responsible for what somebody who bought that refrigerator 20 years ago is doing today. Just, you can't do that.
You made a statement this week about global warming being a much bigger issue than terrorism, weapons of mass destruction.
No, I didn't say that. I said terrorism is a terrible thing, and we should go after terrorists, hunt them down, and kill them. But terrorism is a problem where you see the results today. And we have 1,000 police officers dedicated to intelligence and counterterrorism in this city alone. Weapons of mass destruction in the hands of rogue states or of terrorists is a very scary thing. And that's another problem that society has that we just have to focus on. And a third one is global warming. And I thought Tom Friedman, the columnist in the New York Times, said it very well. It is too late for later. We've got to address this problem now. Now, there are people that say, oh, global warming won't kill the planet, won't hurt us, and they may be right. But the trouble is, by the time you find that out, if you're wrong, it's much too late. And it is, we are, you know, if storms increase, you kill hundreds of thousands of people. One storm recently in Bangladesh a couple of years ago that killed 200,000 people. And, you know, I don't know whether that storm is a result of global warming, but a lot of the science says that these storms are getting stronger. We have parts of the world that are going through droughts for extended periods, which seem to be unique. Maybe it's just a season, a short-term phenomenon, but people are dying for it. Global warming is a very serious thing. And sadly, other parts of the world are taking it much more seriously, as, for example, in Western Europe than we do.
Well, they certainly do. There's no question about
that. But nobody
that.
should suggest we're walking away from terrorism or walking away from keeping crime on the streets down or walking away from keeping weapons of mass destruction out of the hands of rogue states or terrorists. Or nobody should say we should walk away from stopping genocide in, you know, the Sudan and other places. But this is another problem that is just as serious, and we cannot walk away from it.
Political financing, I know that you've been focusing on that. I understand that the law that the city has is being challenged in court on a First Amendment basis.
Yeah, it is. Hopefully the law stands up. What we fundamentally passed a law that prohibits people from doing business with the city from giving large amounts of money, which it is alleged they do to try to buy influence.
I can't imagine.
I can't imagine it either. But even if it's not true, the appearance of it is not good for democracy. Now, there are those that say the law doesn't go far enough, that it should include prohibiting unions, for example, from supporting candidates. And the truth of the matter is I couldn't get that through the city council, but getting one side through is better than nothing.
All right, Mr. Mayor, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to take a short break here, and then when we come back, we'll let everybody on the line here ask you some questions, okay?
Sounds good to me.
1-800-848-WABC is our telephone. As we continue here on the John Gambling Show, Chris Wallace will join us in the next half hour, as will Congressman Peter King, talking about the terrorist surveillance legislation that the House has not passed on. So stick around for that. Right here, we've got Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Phone calls from you, questions, 1-800-848-WABC. Mr. Mayor, we have up first Cheryl in Brooklyn. Cheryl, good morning.
Hello.
Yeah, hi. Cheryl, you've got the mayor. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Good.
I just have a basic question. My kids go to private school, and since the city benefits from less children in public school, you know, from all the kids that go to private school, why isn't there tax credits and vouchers towards tuition, regardless of income?
Well, number one, the city and the state do help private schools. There are textbook funds and transportation funds and a variety of other things to help private schools and reduce their costs. I think the basic answer to your question why we don't have vouchers is politically it is not popular. Even if you think it's a great idea, it would not get through the legislature, and the state legislature would have to pass it. It's also, there's a question as to whether or not it is a good idea. It diverts money from the public schools. And some people say that it would just go to people who can afford to send their kids to public school, to private schools anyways. There was actually a writer who has been a big supporter of vouchers who the other day wrote something saying that he'd looked at, I think it was Milwaukee, where they have it, and it didn't improve education, giving parents that choice. From a fairness point of view, you can certainly make the case that, you know, if you send your kids to private schools, the public doesn't have to pay to educate them, and you should get a credit for it. But politically, it's just not going to happen, I think, in this state. It's a fair ways to phrase
also,
it.
Also, what bothers me about that is the fact that you've already mentioned this. It takes revenue out of the public school system.
Yeah, although what a capitalist would argue is, well, yeah, there's fewer kids, and so you take some of the revenue away. So what? But, you know, the real issue here is that it's not going to happen politically. And I think there is a question as to whether or not it's a good idea. Charter schools are different. Charter schools, I don't think there's any question, they are a great idea, if for no other reason that they provide competition to the public school system. But they don't, those are still schools that in the end really are paid for by the public taxpayer. It's just they operate under a different set of rules, and maybe they can tailor the education to their student body a little bit better. The evidence is mixed as to whether not all charter schools work, and some charter schools are brilliant, some are so-so.
All right, let's go to Gene here in New York City. Gene, you're with John Gambling and Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Go.
Good morning. I enjoyed your comments regarding the Second Amendment and gun control there a little while ago. I'm a resident of Manhattan, a U.S. citizen, former Marine, trained in the care and use of firearms, no criminal, no mental history of any kind. will I be able to get a carry permit in New York City?
I don't know the answer to that, but from what you've described, there's no reason why you would be denied that. Now, we do, the police department gives out carry permits under the basis of, I think, whether you need to have it for your job or for protection, if you can show you you have an occupation which puts you at particular risk to, and you need to defend yourself. But there's certainly no federal law that says you shouldn't be allowed to have a gun. Inner cities tend to have stricter gun laws than the suburbs, and I think rightly so, because we live in a much more dense environment. But New York State, incidentally, does have some of the strictest gun laws in the country. But certainly if you live in the suburbs of New York, you would qualify. And the city, I think you might have to show why you want to carry it. But you sound like you know what you're doing, and there's certainly nothing that you've done wrong.
Gene, thanks for the telephone call. Let's go to Stan out in Long Island. Stan, you've got the mayor. Go. Stan?
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, Mr. Mayor. I'm a retired firefighter, and I just had a question regarding the requirements for the fire department test. Just wanted to ask, why did the fire department or did the city reduce the number of college credits to take the fire department test, as opposed to allowing the PD to keep those 60 college credits?
In the case of the fire department, the federal government sued the city, arguing that the city discriminated in the sense that it had requirements to join the fire department that were not job-related. And so we agreed to reduce the number of credits, but you give you credit for other things as well, and at the same time, doubling the length of time that the probies spend at the Rock at the Fire Academy on Randall's Island. So we think that all of the standards now are germane to the job, and we have to do that because the federal government will get a court order to stop us if we don't, but that also there's no evidence we are dumbing down the requirements or the intellectual level of those who pass the test. And we still have this test that you get, if you pass the test, you get on the list in the order of how well you scored from highest to lowest. And if you're in top half, you probably will get called. And if you're in the bottom half, you probably will not get called. And that's a meritocracy that you want to have. We need firefighters who, particularly in this day and age, as the technology gets better and the jobs that the fire department are called on to do, which, remember, are very different today than in the olden days. In the olden days, you went out and you just fought fires. Today, the fire department responds to automobile accidents where they have to resuscitate people and get people out of wrecks. They intimately involved in our preparation for hazmat operations. They are involved in our inspections to try to reduce the reduce the number of fires, and they've done a great job. So I think, on balance, we didn't reduce the standards. We just changed them.
Mr. Mayor, the theme is behind us. That means our time is up. We'll do it again next Friday.
Looking forward to it.
Me too. Thank you very much, sir. Stick around. We've got lots more to go.